Our next speaker is Dave Gezzi, and he's a senior project manager, acquisitions for Community Housing Works, and he's a guy that's going to implement your housing element or help you implement your housing element. And we've already seen an example of a product of one of his works, so very timely for you, Dave, to wax eloquent.
Well, I thank Bill for including our Solara community in the slides. I don't have any pretty pictures like that in my presentation, so I think it's perfect. The Fallbrook project that was shown in the county is also one of ours. So far today, I think what I'm left with is that housing element updates are a lot of work. And so the question, what I'd like to do is talk about, wouldn't it be nice if that work actually translated into the provision of some affordable units and maybe some of the ways that we can stitch that together so it's not just a plan, but it's something that can be implemented. And I'm curious, of the public agency representatives that are in the room, how many of you are in a jurisdiction where the same department that is drafting the housing element update is also implementing your affordable housing programs or works, what you would say, very closely with your affordable housing programs?
Probably very closely.
Absolutely, in some of the smaller jurisdictions. But I think that there's this breakdown. I think the reason I was invited here today is because I've mouthed off enough about the breakdown between the people who do the planning and the people that do the implementing, and how we talk about each other when we go back to our own rooms or our own offices, but we never really talk with each other. So I thank APA for inviting me to talk today. And kind of as a framing principle, I think we can learn a lot from the sustainability movement, which talks about this idea of the triple bottom line. And so what is that? Well, the first component of that in there at the bottom is social well-being and equity. And that's where our housing elements were originally intended to address. This idea that we can plan and implement our land use in such a way that each socioeconomic group in our communities is benefited. And what SB 375 begins to throw in, or the wrinkle that it adds, is moving up to the top. Can you click for me? This idea of environmental protection and resource conservation. And SB 375 is beginning to challenge us to say, where are we putting these housing units and how is that benefiting the environment? And the third piece that's really kind of critical to implementation is this idea of economic prosperity and continuity, the ability to make the economics of it sustainable and viable. And you know, economic viability, that's just kind of crazy talk when we're talking about affordable housing. So, I'm not a member of APA. I may be a little bit of an alien body to you, so let me introduce myself. My name is Dave. I'm a developer. And I'm beginning to realize I may have a problem. One of our board members defines a developer as someone who is comfortable with ambiguity and eternally optimistic. And you know, at first I kind of, what do you mean comfortable with ambiguity? And I looked at the pro forma spreadsheet that we run when we begin to look at feasibility on a new development project. And I counted, and there are 12,371 cells in the Excel model that we look at to determine the affordability of a project. And then I hand that off to a consultant who runs a more refined model. Now, obviously, 55-year cash flow projections and some of those things, a lot of those calculations are done automatically. But there are probably 200 to 250 variables that we input into that model that are different for each project that affect the bottom line, whether it works economically or not. And I think that's where a lot of the ambiguity comes in. So I wanted to try and share with you a sense of optimism and talk about all the things that we as developers get to be optimistic about. And what I keep coming up with is all of the things that I'm pretty pessimistic about right now. And so I'd like to share with you the top 10 things that keep me up at night as a way of kind of framing the problem. And then we'll get optimistic and we'll talk about how we can work through them together. So let me blow through these really quickly, but I think these are probably of those 250 inputs or variables, these are the 10 that really make a big difference on whether a project is feasible for us to deliver housing to that low income and very low income category. So the first one is, how am I going to compete for land? And it used to be that you just send a gnat catcher an eviction notice and go bulldoze some coastal sage scrub, and sites and land in San Diego County were pretty plentiful. And now that's not true. When we talk about redevelopment, I'm not competing with just the market rate housing developer trying to pay the same price that he or she is for a vacant piece of land, but I've got to go in and figure out what's this used car guy making off his used car lot, and can I pay him enough for the land to not only buy the land, but get rid of his used car business and put something in. And you know, when we talk with redevelopment agencies, they always say, you know, why don't you go by that strip club or that liquor store? And I got to tell you, their economics are off limits. And in trailer parks is the other one. Go buy that trailer park and build them some nicer housing. And the amount of revenue that those sites are generating in our areas that we want to redevelop is incredibly cost prohibitive and really adds to the bottom line. You know, John mentioned this idea of land that may be suitable for redevelopment has an improvement to land ratio of one or less. But the way I do the math, if it has an improvement to land value ratio of one, that means the improvement on it is worth at least as much as the land. So I gotta go in and pay twice land value just to tear it down and go build something else. But that isn't even my biggest problem. My biggest problem are the non-sellers. I was making an offer on a piece of vacant land, family owned, been in the same family for three generations. And the woman said, you know, my daddy told me never to sell this land. It might be worth a lot of money someday. I was offering $1.5 million an acre. That sounded like a lot of money to me. But when we're doing these site inventories, I think we really need to understand how many of these properties that we're putting in inventory are owned by non-sellers. And one of the other soapboxes that I can get on and talk for hours about is how Proposition 13 is not our friend. But this is really a case where it's not. If she really had to pay the property taxes on land that had a value of $1.5 million, $2 million, might be more likely to come into our inventory. Second thing that keeps me up at night, where am I gonna park the cars? So after I get finished designing a project in Excel, which is really where we designed it first with all the numbers, we come down and do the site plan, and every site planner will tell you, the first thing we gotta do is figure the auto circulation. And I've just gotta ask, you know, I'm working on a 80 units of the acre property in a complex in North Park neighborhood, $40,000 of parking space. And that isn't even fully subterranean. So at $40,000 of parking space, are our suburban expectations gonna cripple us from delivering any urban housing? And I really think as we look at infill, as we look at locating next to transit stations, we need to really look at our parking ratios that we have in our general plans. And particularly for affordable housing, you know, by definition, our residents don't have the disposable income and resources that drives, you know, my family of two to own three cars. So why are we imposing the same parking standards on development at that economic level that we do on some of our others? The next challenge, we both hit it. Number three is the building code. And it took me forever to understand ADA requirements and accessibility. And now I get to deal things with fire-rated corridors and exit balconies. And the other thing about the economics of infill development is it's much more expensive to build. When I'm building a two-story suburban walk-up like our Solara project, I built one staircase for two units. I've got this very efficient building design, two-story wood frame construction, very inexpensive. When I start getting into that 80-unit acre project in North Park, I've got to build the concrete parking garage. I've got to do the engineering and build four stories of wood frame construction. I can't build with 2x4 lumber on the first and second floor anymore. I've got to beef that up. I can't just build the unit space and the exterior staircase. I've got corridors to service all of those units. I've got three exit stairs. I've got elevators. the costs are just exponential as we talk about increasing density. And it really, even though we're saving money on the land, we're using the land much more efficiently, which is very important in areas where land is a scarce resource. That savings that I'm getting in the land is getting eaten up by how much more expensive it is to build this building and the building code requirements that I've got to do. There's a real reason why when you can sell for $350, $400 a square foot, high rises go up downtown like wildfire. And as soon as the market isn't there, building stops. And we've got some of these natural thresholds of price that will encourage development that we need to understand a lot better. And you know, the reason that we're not building low and moderate income, low and very low income housing, and even moderate in some jurisdictions, is that by the time I buy the land, design the building, pay the fees for the building permit, I'm lucky if I can build a foundation before I'm already beyond what a low income family can afford. And so by definition, meeting the needs of that market that we've identified as 40% of the area's region needs, we need some sort of subsidy. So where is that money going to come from? As you heard Susan talk about earlier, California frequently has funded these with voter bond initiatives, Proposition 46, Proposition 1C. This year, we're going to see the last of that money go out the door, and I don't see what that next source on the horizon is. So what we've got as we implement this next round of the housing element is the low-income housing tax credit program and some small amount of federal monies through home program and other things. So we're going to have to be doing this with fewer resources. So that means it comes from you guys. It's going to come from the local jurisdictions, and it's going to come from the redevelopment areas. And what really keeps me up at night is how I go in with a straight face and tell you the kinds of financing gaps that you're coming up with in delivering this housing and making it work. Let me just give you an example here. These are three low-income housing tax credit projects. The first one, our Solara project, constructed or approved about 2005. You'll see that the local subsidy was about $4.3 million, which is a combination of the city giving us a dollar per year land lease for 99 years and some cash from the County Housing Authority and the Poway Redevelopment Agency. It was a gap of about $76,000 a unit that allowed us to deliver 56 units of housing there, completely energy efficient, and really a model project. Won not only the Orchid Award, but the ULI Award of the Americas in 2008. The two projects on the right are the two winners of the 9% low-income housing tax credit program for the last two rounds. So the two 2010 winners from San Diego, Brighton Place, a very similar 77-unit community in Poway, had a local subsidy per unit of $143,000. And then Mercado del Barrio in San Diego's Logan Heights neighborhood is likely to be confirmed as the winner here in a couple of weeks. A total local subsidy of $219,000. Wow, yeah. Everyone can clear one more time. So the question is, how long is it going to take when I start it? And because my funding sources are so limited and because those tax credits are competitive, the predictability when we can finally pull together all of that financing and bring it together is a huge challenge. And so you'll hear this from market rate developers, and it's true for us too. The entitlement risk is uncertain enough, but then when I'm bringing in this funding risk and trying to pull together layers of federal financing, state financing, and local financing, you know, I our North Park project is still not out of the ground because we're waiting for that low-income housing tax credit allocation. You've seen how competitive that is. We don't have those kinds of subsidies for that project. And we're now 2 years later than we wanted to be when we bought the land. So the kind of staying power that we need as a nonprofit to invest that risk capital, to tie up the land, to design the building plans, to get ready for applications is really crippling when we can't predict how long it's going to take to get through the process. The other thing, we both got it that time. The other thing that I worry about is, what am I going to do about the neighbors? And when we're talking about the SB 375 world and going in and doing these infill communities, we're going and talking to neighbors in a way that we didn't have to in a greenfield situation. Prior to working in affordable housing, I was the project manager for a large master plan community down in Chula Vista. I think one of the most telling experiences that I had was sitting at a city council meeting, getting approval on a specific plan for a new village in Otay Ranch, 1,500 housing units, three school sites, 27-acre park. On the agenda that same night was a granny flat over a garage in the west side of Chula Vista. 30 speakers showed up to talk about the granny flat. None showed up for the master plan community. So we've got a real challenge in making the case for affordable housing and higher density housing near transit corridors and winning it, because you know your bosses, the city council members, are hearing a lot of opposition. And so navigating that is going to be a real challenge. One of the things we talk about in our office is our code or mantra is to try and do nothing our successors will hate us for. And infill sites and smaller amounts of local funding we're finding are driving us to look at smaller and smaller projects, the projects in the 20, 30, and 40 unit range. And one of the things that Community Housing Works does is provide a real high level of services to our residents. At complexes over a certain size, we have an after-school program where our community building coordinator provides homework assistance, and we provide other educational opportunities for both our residents, a financial fitness program, job assistance if they need it. We can't afford to offer those services in these smaller and smaller projects. The other thing that those 12,000 Excel cells tell me is what we find is the operating cost of the project increases higher than people's incomes increase. And so I'm modeling my operating expenses going up 3.5% a year, but my rent's only going up 2.5% a year. Big project with lots of cash flow, that's a sustainable situation for 40, 50 years or longer. I get into a smaller project with a small amount of cash flow, and my expenses to operate that smaller project a lot less efficient, and I'm looking out and going, 15, 20 years from now, it's going to be really hard to make this thing work. Another challenge that we deal with, and I ask myself, is this really making the difference that we want to make, that our mission-based organization is out here to do? And absolutely for our residents it is. I mean, it's amazing to hear the individual stories of what getting housing costs under control allows a family to then set other financial goals and save for, whether it be education, home ownership. One in seven of our residents who move out actually move up and into home ownership. So really taking some of that pressure on housing costs off allows people to accomplish great things. But I think that there's also an opportunity for us to make a wider difference in our communities, which is also a goal of our organization. And so one of the challenges that I'll put out to you is, how are we using these huge subsidies that we need to deliver affordable housing to leverage other goals that our redevelopment agency or our city may have? We'll talk about that in a minute. And then finally, the biggest thing is, how am I going to convince my board of directors to take these risks? And I think increasingly the challenges that we all face and the case that I have to make to put hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars into a project before we know it can go through and move forward, it's tough work. So how do we do that? And how do we do work on that together? In doing your housing elements, I think one of the great things you can do is determine the true inventory. As long as you're out there doing the groundwork, the ground truthing, hopefully you're talking to brokers and landowners, and you get a great knowledge of where great sites are. And I think together we can be opportunistic land buyers. We've worked with a local North County jurisdiction on our most recent property. The city had a city-owned site. We knew another site was available that they weren't able to acquire right away. We partnered together, we bought the land, and We understand that it may be a little bit of a long haul before we can actually realize units there, but we really work together to try and take advantage of, in that case, it was an REO opportunity and a property that was available at a pretty significant discount. What else can we do together? I think we need to really look hard at our policies and create policy changes that reflect the changed nature of buildings. So I talked about parking being one of those. A lot of our zoning codes are drafted with a very suburban sensibility. When we get into these neighborhoods, these infill neighborhoods, setbacks and FAR and all that really need to be looked at. Next, I'm trying to figure out. Be realistic about the cost. Density bonuses are something that help us out a lot. If I can build more affordable units, I can compete for the price of the land. It also gives our politicians political cover if it's by right that we can do something different or do something more. But the economics of density bonuses are very different in La Mesa than they are in Encinitas because of the value of the land. Focus in on your local and go beyond what the state minimum requires. Next. I'm trying to rush through here. Use your local funds to create that readiness that allows us to leverage other funds. If you could provide pre-development money to tie up land and to build the plan so that we can be project ready and competing for federal funds and state funds, it makes us a lot more effective and competitive in bringing in those other funds. Next. We can talk for a long time. The San Diego Housing Federation is beginning a conversation about what are the changes we need to make in the Housing Tax Credit Program to reduce the amount or the high percentage of the local financing that's necessary to meet this gap. And be happy to talk to you more about how we can work together on that. Prepare for a long pre-development period, but be ready to go when the funding aligns. That kind of very similar to number four there. Create the case for need. One of the things that you can do and work with the affordable housing complexes that are already in your neighborhood is find great people to come and testify to city council to help support your housing element get adopted. In Escondido, where we recently had a project approval, I had four residents come and talk about what being in affordable housing allowed them to do with their lives. I didn't need to talk. They said it all. They made the case for importance, and we got a unanimous vote. So partner with nonprofits in your area to help make that case. Create a phase strategy and build critical mass over time. If we're gonna have to build smaller developments, let's phase them and try and create it over time. So I may build 30 at a time, but I've got 100 in the redevelopment area in 5 years. I can still deliver the services. What I'm able to do in Poway and Escondido to support our residents is a lot greater because we have 6, 7, 8 complexes in the community. So partner with us and help us figure out a way to make that happen. Next. Look to affordable housing to support other city objectives. Affordable housing, identify a site where a new development or a rehabilitation of existing development will help you clean up crime, or be a model for market rate developers, and a case study for new approaches. Another thing in the mixed use environment, a lot of times we have trouble figuring out the economics of making that ground floor use work. That's a great opportunity for you to think about, well, is there an arts organization? Is there a nonprofit organization? Is there some user that can use this space rather than have it sit vacant that supports citywide objectives and builds broader support for the affordable housing community? And then finally, we've got to control the variables that we can control and mitigate the risk. And so one of the things I would encourage you to do is not develop your housing elements in a vacuum. These 10 ideas have been very general on purpose because the variables are so wide and so different between each of your communities. But invite the affordable housing community to participate with you in your jurisdiction and ask them the question about how do we not just make this a planning exercise, but how do we help work together to implement affordable units? There's a lot of power in the public and private partnership. There are things that the cities can do that we can't, and there are things that we can do that the cities can. And working together, we can produce some pretty exciting communities. That's it. I have a lot more to say, obviously. But thank you. So this is Dilbert's definition of a real estate developer. As usual, I worked until midnight last night, Mom. And she says, well, at least you made some extra money. And he said, I don't get paid for overtime. And she says, well, at least it was important work. Gilbert says, not really. My boss made me change my PowerPoint slides, but the changes made them worse. Well, at least you were prepared for your meeting. And it was canceled. But that's okay, because the project isn't funded anyway. So mom says, so you worked for free to worsen a presentation for a meeting that won't happen, for a project that won't exist. Yep. Oh, you must be a real estate developer.
Now my sense is you could go, oh, you must be a planner.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
You reached a point in the agenda where you can tell we're accelerating a thing, and boy, Dave, we probably should give you 3.5 hours. Really a nice job. But we're not.